Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of, well, healthcare and science in the news, debate, dialogue, discussion, and answers to your questions via email and phone. We'll be giving out those phone numbers in just a moment. And we sure had to have a lot of emails this week, so let's get to it. But before we go there, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. One of the things that happens when there's an outbreak, like the current Ebola outbreak that stays in the news for a few days, is it generates discussion. And in the course of the discussion, interesting factoids arise and also innovation. So, for example, the public has learned a great deal about viruses because of the public discourse, and I've learned quite a bit more about Ebola than I ever thought I would need to know. But in doing that, I learned something extremely useful. First of all, let's start with Ebola, and you can think of the Ebola virus as kind of like having the appearance of one of those mops that are made out of strings of rope. So a dust mop or something along those lines. And all of those little moppy fibers are basically designed to attach to cells. You can think of a dust mop. It's supposed to pick up dust, which is why you have all that surface area. Well, the Ebola virus is unique in having a great deal of surface area. I shouldn't say unique, but because there are other viruses that also do this, but unusual. Now, this is why it's so contagious, is because there are so many little receptors on all of those little finger-like mop projections that allow it to grab onto cells. Once it grabs onto the cell, there's actually the insertion structure, which acts like a hypodermic needle that squirts the genetic information contained in the Ebola virus. Seven genes is all it takes, if you can believe that. Anyway, those seven genes are injected by a secondary structure that actually, as soon as the mop fibers attach, they contract and pull the injector towards it. So it's this fascinating little molecular machine. But those mop fibers do present a target. And in fact, one of the ways that the ZMAP, the special experimental drug that's been given to a few people, works is that it acts to interfere with this contraction process, and it, disables it, so to speak. So that's how it works. Now, while Ebola is loose in the bloodstream, it doesn't just affect one cell like the way HIV affects C4 cells. It affects all sorts of things and just about any body tissue, including the lining of the blood vessels, which is how you get into the problem with the hemorrhages and all of the body leakage and the shock that occurs. Now, this starts to look very close to something called sepsis or septic shock, in which through the mechanism of toxins being released in the bloodstream, the endothelial wall is damaged. And this brings out information that appeared in the opinion pages of the New York Times, of all places. And a link was sent to me by Kip. This is an opinion piece that was authored by David Fedson and Stephen Opel. And what they propose is using statins, that's right, Lipitor and its friends, to protect the endothelial lining in people who are being treated for Ebola. They point to research that shows that statins actually have a unique property of protecting the blood vessels in sepsis patients. There was a paper published in Critical Care in 2012 that demonstrated that statins early in the course of sepsis reduce the occurrence of organ failure by 83%. Now, organ failure is what kills people in sepsis and also what kills them in Ebola. So what these rather forward-thinking and creative gentlemen are suggesting is, hey, why not try giving statins to people with Ebola. We know that it is a relatively safe drug to use. It's cheap and generic and widely available, in contrast to ZMapp, which is not any of the above. So why not give it a try? And for me, the concept of statins for sepsis was a new one. And I wanted to put it out there because I know there are a lot of healthcare workers who listen to this program. So here it is, Critical Care 2012. I don't have the actual reference, but it certainly seems to me that it would be easy to find on a Google search. So let's all just get a little bit smarter, right? That's the whole point of this program. One quick, well, let's just call it a human interest story. A 13-year-old girl has done important research that may help save the lives of many AIDS patients. Many people with AIDS develop an illness called cryptococcus. It's a life-threatening infection of the lungs and the brain and is actually responsible for one-third of all AIDS-related deaths. The article in question appeared in the August 21st Public Library of Science, Pathogens. And what this 13-year-old girl, in alliance with a researcher at UCLA named Scott Fuller and a little girl, not coincidentally, Scott Fuller's daughter, Ellen Fuller, and chief of molecular genetics and micro at Duke University, Joseph Heitman, did, was they sent Ellen out for her summer project. She sampled 30 different tree species and took 58 soil samples, over 109 swabs from tree species, to isolate Cryptococcus, which lives in trees, grows on trees. Well, how about that? Some diseases grow on trees. Turns out that that she identified three trees that are the primary vectors for Cryptococcus: a Canary Island pine, this is a good one, Pohutukawa, I guess that's probably from Hawaii, and American sweet gum. These are the three environmental hosts and sources of these human infections. So it allows us to, well, for one thing, not put any of those trees on hospital grounds. Let's remove the vectors and help keep AIDS patients from getting infected with this terrible fungus. I wanted to be sure that I covered this email. It came from Susan in Los Osos, California. Dear Dr. Don, I was backpacking in the Eastern Sierras August 3rd through August 8th this year, where something bit me and caused a smaller than a dime blemish that is sore but not itchy. I'm now wondering if this could have anything to do with the symptoms I've been experiencing since Thursday, August 14th. That's to say about a week after her trip. Headache, achy neck, back and shoulders, lightheaded feeling, and on and off temperature of up to 102 degrees for the last 4 days. This afternoon, I noticed small reddish spots on my chest that are scarcely sprinkled down to my navel. This is like nothing I've ever experienced before. I'm a healthy 57-year-old and haven't been ill for years. Please advise me, most knowledgeable one. I had to throw that one, that ending in. Susan, I'm really worried that you may have contracted a tick-borne illness. It is a kind of a truism in medicine that ticks are nature's dirty needle. If you were walking on the beach and you stepped on a hypodermic needle, you'd get to a doctor PDQ, right? Well, I think you need to do that because you have been bitten by nature's dirty needle and you're showing signs of being infected by that. While it could be Rocky Mountain spotted fever, that would be unlikely. Far more likely would be Lyme disease, anaplasma, or I'm betting on babesiosis, which are all common tick-borne illnesses. And particularly, babesiosis is widely found in ticks and causes pretty much the same sort of illness that you're describing. So I want to urge you to get to a doctor, ideally an infectious disease doctor, but if you can't manage that, start at an urgent care, but do it today. I hope you're listening. I wanted to also send out the email to Alma in Santa Cruz. Alma's email reads, please speak about any negative aspects of using melatonin long-term with rheumatoid arthritis. I've been taking 3 milligrams for the past 9 months on a nightly basis, with an occasional week without it. I find it helps me obtain a deeper level of sleep and has made sleeping with a CPAP much more bearable. I've read many articles on the internet stating that there's a plentitude of contraindications of long-term melatonin use for those who have RA. Personally, I haven't experienced any flare-ups while taking melatonin, but I'm still interested in knowing if long-term use should be avoided. Well, Alma, it's a good question because, you see, you have an intact pineal gland, and so you already are making melatonin. I was interested about the research that was out there, and I wanted to just present to people what I found. First of all, we know that melatonin is a potent antioxidant and tends to promote the immune response, by which I mean it helps fight off cancers and it helps the immune system be stronger. Now, if you're suffering from an autoimmune disease, we're all concerned that that might not necessarily be a good thing. And indeed, studies looking at rheumatoid arthritis patients show that melatonin levels generally are higher in the serum in people with rheumatoid arthritis. Also, a very interesting article I found showed that the circadian rhythm of people with rheumatoid arthritis was different. Their melatonin levels were higher overall. That was statistically significant. But more importantly, their melatonin didn't drop in the morning. For a couple of hours, it stayed high. This is unlike that of quote-unquote normal patients and tracks very suspiciously with some of the circadian features of rheumatoid arthritis, which are gelling and stiffness in the morning that tends to get better throughout the day. So is the rheumatoid arthritis manifesting as higher melatonin levels, and that's not the cause, but simply a manifestation, or are the melatonin levels causing trouble? Well, none of the data on humans tell us, but there's one study where they took rats who were a model for rheumatoid arthritis, which isn't this exactly the same disease, but it's rheumatoid arthritis-like. These rats then had their pineal gland removed and were monitored for flare-ups of their rheumatoid arthritis. These rats actually did better without a pineal gland, which is to say their melatonin levels were low. And when researchers replaced the melatonin at normal physiologic doses, the rats' arthritis got worse. And when they gave extra melatonin, the rheumatoid arthritis in the rats got much, much worse. So I'd say we have enough suspicion here and enough of a smoking gun and something at least to suggest that there is a cause and effect vector from the melatonin to the RA symptoms that I'd advise you to go elsewhere for your sleep. Other things that might help you would include 5-hydroxytryptophan, or tryptophan, both of which are now available again. Doses of around 250 to 500 milligrams generally work well for sleep. Chamomile, particularly German chamomile, passion flower, lemon balm, and magnesium, particularly when taken in combinations, and there's several good combo products out there, can also be extremely beneficial for sleep. And we're going to go to the phones, and that is for Joe in Marina. Hello, Joe. Welcome.
Good morning. How are you?
Hello. How are you?
Oh, doing fine. Thank you. Thank you for taking the time to speak with me. I have a question about sexual health for you, if I may.
Go ahead.
Hit age 50, but it started before 50. I was on SSRIs for a few years, and I went off of them for a few reasons, one of which I was feeling better mentally, and also sexual dysfunction they were causing. In particular, inability to reach orgasm.
Mm-hmm, very common.
However, even off of the SSRIs, even though I have no problem getting an erection, I still have tremendous difficulty reaching orgasm, and it's making life, yeah, I can reach it, but it has to be very vigorous, and it's making life for my girlfriend, who's not a spring chicken either, like myself, a little bit difficult. I was wondering if you have any suggestions with regard to this.
Well, are you taking any other medications?
Nothing.
No testosterone, no Viagra, nothing like that?
No.
Okay. Actually, I don't. I have seen some lore on the internet about use of various herbal agents to help with this, but I haven't actually seen any, you pardon the expression, hard data on the matter. And so I really have to sort of take the fifth on this one. But I want to thank you for being willing to get on the air and ask a question like that, because I know from my private practice that you're not alone, and this is an issue. So if there's any people out there who are also courageous and want to speak up with solutions they may have found for the matter, let's open the phone to calls for that. And keep listening, Joe, and who knows what might turn up.
Thank you, Doctor. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Now, for all of you Alzheimer's and Parkinson's patients out there, this is early data, but I think could be extremely interesting. Also might turn out to be nothing, but it won't hurt. So if it's in the might help, won't hurt category, I'm happy to offer it to you. Coming soon to a health food store near you, Pungni Caligan, P-U-N-I-C-A-L-A-G-I-N. This is a polyphenol found in pomegranate, primarily in the peel, but it's also in the seeds somewhat. It actually inhibits inflammation in microglia, brain microglia, which are the bad guys in the production of Alzheimer's and Parkinson's disease. It's a good antioxidant, but it has a particular affinity for the microglia. So the researcher here, a Dr. Olahide, is recommending that one use 100% pomegranate juice, and he's saying consuming about 4 to 8 ounces a day provides about as much of this substance as he found to be inhibitory. And this is in cell culture, but I still think it's persuasive, and taking a glass, and I have no affiliation with the pomegranate juice industry, but I am, you know, very, very sympathetic for the creep factor of having a family history of dementia or a family history of Parkinson's, or even being diagnosed with early stages of these diseases. And we seek around drastically trying to respond to these threats on our personal health horizon. And so from a personal standpoint, you can bet I'll be getting my pomegranate juice down every day one way or another. Our next email is from Andrea in Houston, Texas. After 5 months of debilitating diarrhea, I underwent an upper and lower endoscopy. First, I was diagnosed with H. pylori in the stomach. Is there a better way to know which antibiotics to take, how long, versus my GI doctor just prescribing his typical treatment? I'll answer on this first before I read the rest of her email. The standard treatment for H. pylori is pretty good, but it's important to document recovery, and so looking for the H. pylori antigen on a stool test or H. pylori DNA, which is also widely available now through alternative medicine labs and fairly accurate, looking for that DNA in your stool a month after you finish the therapy is a good idea. In my large colon, the pathologist diagnosed unspecified microscopic inflammation, and my doctor prescribed the FODMAP diet, Pepto-Bismol, and I take probiotics. Are there other treatment plans that might be beneficial? Lastly, what is the best way to repopulate good gut yeast and bacteria when I finish the prescribed antibiotics for H. pylori? So the first thing I want to say, Andrea, is you're in Houston, Texas. Go to the Institute of Functional Medicine website, which is functionalmedicine.org, and put in your zip code and find yourself an FM doctor, because this is a complex issue and it's not something one can really do justice to in this context. But in broad strokes, the FODMAP diet is primarily a diet that addresses symptoms of irritable bowel. It may or may not help with your diarrhea, which I suspect is not at all related to your H. pylori. That's probably just a marker of an unhealthy microbiome. And the antibiotics that you're going to use to treat the H. pylori, while I do recommend therapy, are not going to be the ones that you need to really restore a good microbiome. typically when I am addressing this sort of an issue, I will use an elimination diet. You'll find that on my website. It's similar but not identical to the FODMAP diet, and it removes most of the common food antigens because the source of that nonspecific inflammation in your intestine is most likely one of two things, if not both. And those two things are the presence of too many pathogenic bacteria, that is to say, weeds in your personal garden, or the presence of food sensitivities, or as I said, or both. People can develop inflammatory reactions to certain foods, and it's idiosyncratic, but it's far more common in people who have hay fever or allergies or a history of eczema. So if that fits you, well, that's a point on the side of this possibility. Either way, this chronic low-grade inflammation of the intestine interferes with one of the primary intestinal functions, which is keeping, keeping things out of the bloodstream that are supposed to be out of the bloodstream. And so you end up creating more food sensitivities, and it's a vicious cycle. That needs to be stopped by strengthening the intestinal membrane, and there's various substances to do that, typically a combination of L-glutamine, omega-3 fatty acids, vitamin D, and zinc is used. What else we do is some sort of plant antimicrobial, usually for a long time, month and a half or something like that, and aggressive re-inoculation with large doses of mixed probiotic flora. And oh my goodness, the minutiae and the rabbit hole we can jump down when we start talking about which probiotics and how to dose them. So like I said, you really need the guidance of a functional medicine physician, and you're lucky that you live where you live because you will be able to find one. So I hope that helps you. Let's move on to our next email. This one from Pat in Santa Cruz. Pat brought to my attention a very good website called responsibletechnology.org, which is really dedicated to the problems of GMOs and has good links to credible scientific sources. We had talked last week about glyphosate, and I mispronounced it glyphosate, and excuse me for that. It's always fun to have an editor listening to you. Thank you, Pat. So she pointed out that she had learned from this website, and I learned that it was true when I did a Google search on it, that glyphosate is also an antibacterial. So there is a spermicide. So the potential of us consuming residual glyphosate in soybeans, particularly that have been made Roundup Ready, or also other food crops which have that gene inserted in them, is, I think, becoming a bigger and bigger concern in my mind. So thank you very much, Pat, for the information, and yet another reason why we need to stay away from GMO foods. Not necessarily that the genetic modification makes the food toxic, but that the genetic modification allows the food to be toxic, to have toxins applied to it, which we then consume. So very important objection, and wanted to thank you. Had this email from Anne in Santa Cruz. Source vitamin D possible toxicity. It's highly speculative email, but I'm going to put it out there. Hello, Dr. Dawn. I've been curious about the source of vitamin D and the possible toxic contaminants. Vitamin D is cholecalciferol, which is from lanolin from sheep's wool. How would we know that this is safe when sheep are dipped regularly for parasites? How would this be tested to control possible toxic accumulation when so many people are encouraged to take vitamin D? Well, I went looking on this, and indeed, vitamin cholecalciferol is, of course, being an animal product that's manufactured in mammalian bodies. It had to come from mammals somewhere, and lanolin is indeed the primary source. The pesticide issue, I think, is probably covered by the way in which the extraction is done, and there is a purification process that I believe takes care of the pesticides. Before the vegans get really scared about not being able to take vitamin D, I do want to point out that there is a vitamin D from lichens and mushrooms. I did not know this, but mushrooms actually produce vitamin D as well. And so you can get vegan sourced vitamin D. So I hope that acts as a sufficient comfort on that one. Since we have time, I'm going to launch into a science lesson. Boys and girls, we're going to talk about brown fat and thermogenesis. Now, there are two kinds of fat in our bodies. The white fat, which is the one we're all so familiar with, which accumulates in the butt and the belly and various other places where we'd rather not have it. And brown fat, which is present also in the same locations, but has more mitochondria in it. And actually, that's where the color comes from. It really does look brown because the mitochondria are upregulated, and all of those mitochondria actually use the fatty acids in their cells to generate heat. This is why, among other things, in the wintertime, in cold climates, people eat more and don't gain weight. They eat more because they're actually upregulating their brown fat and using it to keep from freezing to death. Brown fat in adult humans is found mostly in the neck, upper back, and shoulders. And there are nerves that go into this brown fat that secrete epinephrine, which revs up the mitochondria and creates heat. This mechanism is now being worked out. And once the receptors are identified, the search for the drug begins. And believe me, the first people who come up with the synthetic drug that attaches these receptors, and they're called ERR alpha and ERR gamma, if you want to go looking them up on the internet, well, it'll be one of those blockbuster pharmaceutical drugs that, you know, Viagra would be an example of one that just keeps on, it's the keeps on giving, shall we say, to the stockholders. Low temperatures activate this system. But again, researchers are really, really starting to get down to the nitty-gritty level to understand the receptors. And what they've identified is that it's complicated, and you're going to have a drug that hits several different receptors just right. But if they can do it, it could be pretty amazing. Now, there are also brain processes that control the conversion of white fat to brown fat. And researchers at Southwestern Medical Center have actually identified neural pathways that affect this. There is a receptor found widely in the brain in the autonomic nervous system called melanocortin 4 receptors. These are key in regulating glucose metabolism and energy expenditure, and they regulate the ability of white fat to become brown fat, and they also help regulate blood glucose levels. And this was found using mouse models where they will delete a certain, you know, you can basically order up a mouse that's missing anything nowadays, which in and of itself is both sort of, I don't know, it's kind of creepy, but it's also sort of miraculous. And it's revolutionized research, but you also have to stop and think, okay, can we generalize this to an actual living, breathing, wild-type human? However, with these knockout mice, researchers are able to really unravel the pathways. If a stimulator to the melanocortin 4 receptor can be found, and something that actually crosses the blood-brain barrier, we may be able to have not only another treatment for diabetes, something we need, but a way for people to lose weight and normalize their system. And turning up brown fat, well, I guess if we all start taking a diet drug that upregulates our brown fat, we will collectively contribute to global warming. But according to something I just recently read, all we have to do is stop eating hamburger and move to other meat sources, and we can basically stop global warming. Interesting thought. And I wonder if it's true. Why don't we give it a try? Let's go to our next caller. And that is Jennifer in Monterey.
This is Amy in Carmel.
Oh, I'm sorry, Amy. I picked up the wrong phone. Amy, you're on the air. Jennifer, please hold. We'll take you next. It's your turn.
I tuned in just a couple of minutes late after you started talking about pomegranate juice, but my ears, so I didn't hear what that was about, but my ears pricked up because dementia was mentioned, and I have a quite, unfortunately, robust family history on my mother's side of dementia. And I signed up for the Alzheimer's Prevention Registry website. It's a wonderful, big group, an effort to get all kinds of family history and, linkages. I think they started about a year ago. And they send out newsletters with all the current study results. And the other thing is that you can sign up for studies on this website. And there are three going on now, and they look for volunteers. The first one is an A4 study. It is a third, a level 3 study. The levels 1 and 2 went very well. I heard about this information. It's from Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston, and it is a study of an antibody to beta amyloid, and it's going on in major centers all over the United States. The only thing you have to be is between 65 and 85, which I am, and there's a big center at Stanford. So I encourage people who might be interested in being involved in a study. They are looking for people to check out that Alzheimer's Prevention Registry website. There are two other studies. One is an inhalant, insulin inhalant study. Interesting premise about the effect of getting insulin directly to the brain and loss of neurons.
That
one can accept people who have had a pre-diagnosis of, let's say, dementia mm-hmm. or some memory loss. And there's a third one, I think it's called Lifeline. I can't remember the exact name of that one, but I just encourage people to, if they qualify, to be part of these studies and try to, help find ways that we can deal with it.
Right. I think it's extremely important.
Yeah.
I'm hoping that with the combination of being able to, in these studies, I'm sure they're doing people's DNA and,
yes,
tracking
are.
That and correlating that, because there isn't just one disease here.
Right.
And so, first of all, we have to tease out the strands of several different diseases and genetic combinations and environmental histories
uh-huh.
that are going to contribute to the same endpoint, which is the accumulation of this toxic form of beta amyloid.
Yeah.
But there is it's clearly an extraordinarily complex situation, similar in many ways to autism in terms of having multiple threads and not being purely genetic. What I do in general with my family history of dementia is I think the data on green tea and green tea extract is excellent. And the other data is on exercise. And anyone with a family history of dementia basically needs to maintain a healthy body weight, exercise regularly, and drink a lot of green tea or take a supplement. And I think on the basis of this pomegranate study, although it's very preliminary, the idea of going at the microglia level, which is the inflammation, I think that's higher up the chain of events than the actual accumulation of beta amyloid. I've looked at this, been watching this research for over 20 years, and I think that it's kind of like if you hurt your back, you don't take out the garbage. So the garbage accumulates, but it's not the garbage that caused the back pain in the first place.
Yeah.
And so the fact that there's a lot of unempty trash cans in the house doesn't necessarily mean that the trash is the trouble.
Yeah.
It ultimately becomes a problem, but is that the front end or the back end? And the microglia stuff and some of the studies show increased brain inflammation in young adults who have the really bad bad DNA and the really bad family history. So that in those changes are probably present even at infancy. In one study that I read, they were looking at functional MRI and what was going on in the hippocampus, and they showed differences that were correlating to whether a person had the double APOE4 allele. Mm-hmm. In infancy, they were seeing variations in brain function. So this goes very, very deep, and it's a lifetime of exposure, and yet not everybody with that DNA goes on to develop Alzheimer's.
Right.
That's where the gold lies, is what makes those people different.
Yeah.
And that's why we now being able to do whole genome, and you know, if we can get the cost of a complete genome down to $1,000, then we can do enough research, because you're going to need large numbers.
Yeah, and it is getting much, much cheaper.
It's not quite there yet, but it's getting close.
Oh, the other thing I learned, which was really heartening, was that they've finally gotten a bunch of money for Alzheimer's, which had maybe only a tenth as much funding from the NIH as did cancer, and it's going to certainly impact, you know, we know huge, huge, huge numbers of people. And cost a huge amount of money.
Yeah, and Alzheimer's patients in general tend to be very physically healthy, which is possibly also a clue. Who knows? But I mean, in terms of their longevity,
right.
they have good longevity relative to the entire age cohort. Well, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate all that information.
Yeah.
Have a great day.
Bye. You too.
Bye bye. And let's go now to Jennifer. Hello, Jennifer. Sorry to keep you waiting.
No problem. I know you've spoken about this subject before, but I'm just going to ask again. I wanted you to speak about statins and some of the possible health risks to the long-term use of statins. I have friends who are in medical profession and retired physicians, and one in particular who has gone off statins completely and is really adamant about his concern about their long-term health risks. And specifically simvastatin, if you could speak to that. I have two parents, both of which are on that drug, and I'm concerned about them being on it long-term, particularly my aging father, who's pushing 80 and in the last 6 months has really complained about feeling more tired and feeling weaker in his legs. And my sort of alarm bells went off, and I told him to speak to his cardiologist about it. But I'm concerned about what those long-term risks might be.
Well, in a word, mitochondrial toxicity, which is a big concern. Now, let's go back. The way a statin works to lower cholesterol is that it inhibits an enzyme called HMG-CoA reductase, which is a big mouthful, but part of the production of LDL, which is the lumpy, unhealthy cholesterol, which when it gets oxidized, gets into the artery and contributes to the formation of plaque. This is the hypothesis that that's how statins help you. That's, by the way, probably wrong. But regardless of that, the whole intention of taking a statin was to lower LDL levels, and we use LDL as a marker and try to shoot for a level. The reason this is a problem is that our bodies need to produce a compound called coenzyme Q10. It's critically important in the mitochondria. It's also a potent antioxidant. If you don't make enough CoQ10, your mitochondria don't efficiently burn carbon to make energy. Because the whole thing is about taking carbon bonds and turning them into phosphate bonds. It's a complicated process. You're juggling a lot of oxygen-free radicals in the process in those mitochondria. And without adequate CoQ10, those oxygen-free radicals hang around and damage the mitochondrial DNA. And then the mitochondria can't reproduce inside the cells. And eventually the cell will kill itself, because mitochondria kind of decide whether or not the cell keeps on living. If it happens to be a nerve cell that has defective mitochondria, well, there goes the neuron. So there are implications for Alzheimer's. There are people who are clearly very sensitive, maybe because of pre-existing heavy metal exposure, maybe because of their genetics, we don't know. But there are people who are canaries, and they'll get statin brain, and they'll feel foggy, and then when they stop taking their statin, they'll clear up. The muscle ache, another group of canaries. And we know that even healthy, people who don't have cholesterol issues, if you put them on a statin and then send them to the gym and have them lift weights, the amount of muscle damage that they get from a workout is greater if they're on a statin. And we can measure that by measuring CPK in their bloodstream. So there are a lot of reasons to say this stuff isn't good for you. I am pretty sure, you hear the uncertainty in my voice, I'm pretty sure that you can mitigate a lot of the damage that statins cause by putting people on fairly high doses of ubiquinol, which is a form of CoQ10 that's more readily absorbed. So ubiquinol, a couple hundred milligrams a day. For anyone who's on a statin, that's what I do. And I have had people come in who wouldn't take a statin because they're like, well, you know, I got muscle aches. And I'll, oh, well, let's try this. Let's give you the CoQ10 for 10 days and then start the statin, see if you get the muscle aches again. And they don't. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean I think they should be on a long-term statin. But if they want to because they've had a heart attack, mm-hmm. that's the person, I think, that really has some benefit. It's, you know, if you've had a heart attack, it makes sense to be on a statin and take a bunch of CoQ10. If you haven't had that heart attack, it's debatable. I mean, you have to treat like 50 people to prevent one heart attack in that secondary prevention group, in primary prevention, which is where you haven't gotten the disease. So that's a, you know, I don't necessarily think it's worth it. But the mechanism probably has nothing to do with cholesterol anyway. It's probably anti-inflammatory. Here's the other shoe on simvastatin and other statins as well. I don't think simvastatin's uniquely bad. I really think they're all probably going to do the same thing. And that's diabetes. So
that was my next question.
Right. There is emerging a very strong correlation between developing diabetes and long-term statin use, and it's particularly true for females, who, by the way, are the ones that it's harder to prove actually get any benefit from being on a statin.
Now, what if someone is already diabetic? And because it seems like...
Excellent question. You know what the recommendation is if they're already diabetic? Mm-hmm. Put them on a statin. No, right. Doesn't matter what their cholesterol is. The current recommendation, which, by the way, if you go against as a doctor at your own peril, mm-hmm. The current recommendation is everybody who's diabetic should be on a statin. End of discussion. There's a period at the end of that sentence.
Because
it does demonstrate, because essentially it has to do with the event rate of heart attacks. And indeed, diabetics are at the same level of risk for a heart attack as somebody who already had a heart attack. Diabetes is a nasty disease. It damages the blood vessel wall. So as a result, being on that anti-inflammatory, is beneficial. Now, there's one study, it's probably 5 years old, there may have been subsequent ones, but I remember this one, where they used high-dose fish oil, also a potent anti-inflammatory, and we're talking like 4,000 milligrams of fish oil. That's a lot. And Lipitor, which was at the time, you know, the poster child super statin, and they got the same results after 4 or 5 years. Event rates were reduced in both groups compared to placebo, and they were reduced equivalently, a little bit more for the Lipitor, but the statin and the high dose omega-3 actually came out pretty much the same. So what does it mean? Statins probably work because they're potent anti-inflammatories. They do work. If you're a diabetic, you might be just as well off taking four grams of fish oil, and that's kind of what I encourage people to do. I encourage them professionally at my peril, but we have a full discussion. I document it, and I hope that'll keep the lawyers off my back. Because sooner or later, one of these people I've advised not to take a statin is going to have a heart attack. And sooner or later, somebody I've advised to take a statin is going to have a heart attack. Mm-hmm. So is there a cause and effect to my advice? Probably not. But I will still get blamed, or could mm-hmm. potentially get blamed. And you just have to take a deep breath. But it's a deep breath, let me tell you.
Yeah, well, it just seems like, I mean, I'm biased, but it just seems like in the medical industry, you hit a certain age and people are just like boom, boom, boom.
It is. And doctors are under such pressure.
These people are going to be on this drug for, what, 20, 30 years?
That's right.
And that concerns me.
You were totally right to be concerned.
All right. Well, I appreciate your input. Thank you.
Yeah, I basically think if you want to advise your parents, remember, you're going to be advising people of your parents' generation to go against doctors' advice, and good luck with that.
Right. Yeah. Well, I did a bunch of research and looked up all these things, even on the FDA's website, about simvastatin and possible side effects and risks of long-term use, and sent them about 50 articles and said, take two or three of these with you into your doctor's office. Your doctor's going to hate it. But in my mind, any cardiologist or any medical person at all who has a patient who actually takes the time to educate themselves a lot should be commended, and they should have the patience to educate that person, even if it's against what they know to be their best advice.
Well, the problem, let's just agree that the statins have a lot of momentum, and it's going to take a while to turn that boat, but maybe we should think about turning the helm.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. I did want to say that I use a lot of monacolins, which is a red yeast rice. It is a compound that is statin-like, but it has certain properties that make me feel that it probably is less dangerous. And like I said, I always use a lot of CoQ10, and I really do think that that's where many of these adverse results are coming from, is that we're inducing a CoQ10 deficiency, and over 20 years that's going to lead to dementia and congestive heart failure and all sorts of bad things, even if it does actually successfully prevent a heart attack. Let's find a different way to do that. Let's go now to Cheryl in Santa Cruz. Hello, Cheryl. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Don. Thanks for being here.
Hi.
I love your show. I listened to it for years. My question today is about migraines.
Go ahead.
I've never had one before, and it came on last evening or maybe around 5 really suddenly, and I couldn't drink water. I couldn't eat. I had blurry vision. I had extreme headaches. It lasted all night. I'm just surprised. I'm pretty healthy, 38-year-old. I didn't know why that happened, and I wanted to know about that.
Well, let me first ask you, you said you've never had a migraine before?
No.
Okay.
And that's what I'm assuming it is.
So. That's what we're going to drill down on.
Okay.
Is it right? First of all, it's a bad headache. Got that. Does it?
Yeah.
Is it stronger on one side or the other of your head?
Yes, on the left.
Stronger on the left. And is it pounding with your pulse?
No.
It's dead.
The whole head was completely painful, yeah.
Yeah, so it wasn't a pounding headache. And did you say you vomited?
I felt like I was going to the whole night.
Okay, so you were nauseated. Were there any visual symptoms involved here? Double vision?
At first,
or?
Actually, the opposite side went blurry on the periphery. My right eye vision field went blurry on the periphery. And then I just was really sensitive to light. I had to drive home from the grocery store and lay down.
All right. Cheryl, is there somebody there with you?
No.
All right. Do you have a friend or a neighbor who can drive you somewhere?
Yeah.
All right. I want you to ask that person to drive you to the emergency room because you need a CT scan. This is not something you should do yourself. You really should have someone drive you, okay? Hopefully this is a false alarm. I'm not, I can't make a diagnosis over the telephone. But if you were my patient and you called me with this history, this is the advice I would be giving you. And the reason is that at your age, a first migraine cannot be assumed to be a migraine. It is, and the fact that you got visual symptoms on the opposite side of the pain makes it sound like it may have been more of a structural thing. And that could be a very, very small hemorrhage. And
okay. I do feel significantly better this morning. I still have a headache.
It doesn't matter, okay? The fact is there is an entity where you have a little flaw in the blood vessel. It's called an aneurysm. Mm-hmm. And they'll leak. And when they leak, you get the worst headache of your life, often with nausea. And the fact, like I said, that you had visual symptoms on the opposite side makes it seem like there was a localized thing. Migraines are a generalized thing. Although they do tend to be one-sided, the visual symptoms are bilateral. So that worries me. I am also, I'm concerned that you may have had what's called a sentinel bleed, where you get a little leak from a bad blood vessel. that's usually what happens just before the blood vessel leaks majorly, which we call a hemorrhagic stroke. So this there's other things it could be a meningioma, could be this, that, and the other thing. But that's the one where you do not pass go, you do not, you know, you move directly to the ER and you tell them, worst headache of my life, right, it hurt on the left, right-sided visual changes, and you're 38 and never had a migraine. And if the ER doctor has any sense at all, you'll be heading into the scanner in pretty short order.
Okay. Well, I will call somebody. Thank
Please,
you.
That really needs to happen.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you for calling. I'm really glad you called. Okay, bye-bye. You know, the ambulance is probably a good idea. The main thing is get there pronto. I had an off-air. What do we know? What do I know about Krillia to treat benign prosthetic hyperplasia? And I'll have to take the fifth on that. This has been a day for the Fifth Amendment. I do not have any knowledge about that, or at least not by that spelling. This email from Diana in Canandaigua, New York. First, and I want to thank you for your service. You can't imagine how much I've learned over the years. I so appreciate your unique posture combining science and data in conjunction with the alternative and functional. Functional medicine docs are only a dream in our geographic area at this point, but I'll keep hoping. My question, can you please comment on your thoughts in regards to essential oils and the science behind their efficiency, specifically frankincense and its immune support or depression support, and antibacterial relaxation properties of oils such as lavender and the like? I'm specifically interested in young living oils and applying them to the foot using the VitaFlex method. Diane, I'm not familiar with that company or with the VitaFlex method, but when you apply essential oils to the skin, it's really important to do that rapidly, to do that with dilution. Some essential oils, when applied directly to the skin recurrently, can cause just a very, very nasty rash and sometimes even a chemical burn. So these are potent substances that need to be applied with some respect. Now, frankincense, you'll remember from the three wise men, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Frankincense is Boswellia, which is a very good anti-inflammatory and also an antibacterial. So we use it, for example, we had a earlier email where I talked about functional medicine techniques for bowel recovery, and we use it for that fairly frequently. I typically will give capsules. If I were giving essential oil, I wouldn't give essential oil orally because I just wouldn't know how to dose it. But it would probably work if you got the dosing right. The topical uses, of course, in the antibacterial realm as well. So if you're treating a skin infection, diluted oil could be useful. And there is some science in the naturopathic literature that validates these comments I'm making about antibacterial and anti-inflammatory. I really have hunted, and I did another literature search this morning for this, and I really have hunted for good data on lavender and relaxation. And the problem is it's kind of hard to measure stress and relaxation. And of course, with relaxation, the placebo effect is very strong. As a clinical hypnotist, I can tell you that when you say to a person in the right tone of voice, in the right circumstances, relax, they do. Now, if you take a bottle in your hand that says it will relax you, and you've decided that it will relax you, it will. But is that science? And part of the problem is that with placebos is that in order to prove something scientifically, you'd actually have to, how can you use something so fundamental as smell? You'd have to come up with a really good fake lavender smell and then test the real lavender against the fake lavender. And even then, if you're hitting the right receptors and evoking the right memory response, then the lavender might, the fake lavender might still work, and it wouldn't disprove the concept. So this is one where I just don't think we quite have the technology yet to prove or disprove the relaxation aspects of lavender, and that's why there's no good data. But certainly anecdotally, it's a fairly powerful thing. And just parenthetically, you should know that I do use that quite a lot for when I'm treating patients with insomnia and anxiety issues. And again, anecdotally, I think it's quite helpful. Well, we've come to the end of another hour. So long, and stay healthy till then.